Side honor them crazy murderers will never run from inside. You try to keep me down cause you see no joy. All them knows them from, so you call a man a boy. I in a tie can just see, open up your eyes.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right, in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real.
And here we go, folks. It is Monday, November the 6th, 2023, and you are listening to today's early morning edition of the Ugly Truth broadcast. Welcome to the program, folks. Hope you're all doing well. Those of you of goodwill, as we like to say on this program, those of you who are not of goodwill and who have dedicated yourselves and your beings to the destruction and the misery of the rest of us, well, as was famously said by the greatly missed Michael Collins Piper years ago, you can all take a running jump straight into hell. Again, welcome to the program, folks. Hope you had a good weekend. Yeah, we're a day late getting here, folks. I was just busy with family business yesterday. A birthday party, folks. My youngest daughter is turning 10, and so we had a big family get-together for her. And I was just too busy with that to find my way out here into my little man cave that I now have, and in order to do this program. But here we are nonetheless. Lots to discuss, folks. It's probably not going to be a short program. It'll probably be a long one like last one. And by the way, folks, I received quite a few emails from people talking about how disturbed and unnerving the last program was. And it was due, I think, entirely, well, to two things. Number one, the subject matter itself. And number two, the fact that it was, it was the foundation for this discussion was the words themselves that you can hear with your own ears in plain English, the words of the rabbis talking about their plans for destroying all of us, And you're right, folks, it is a very unnerving and disturbing thing when you hear coming out of the mouths of these people, the most powerful people in the world, by the way, let's not forget that fact, that they have had this death warrant out against all of us for thousands of years. This is a point that needs to be repeated over and over and over again, folks, is that these people, these world destroyers, these arsonists, these followers of Judaism, they have hated you, they have hated us thousands of years before we were ever born. And at least judging, by the events that are taking place in the news on a daily basis, that it appears as though, folks, while they indeed have had this gun pointed at our head for thousands of years, they have now cocked back the trigger and have put their, or cocked back the hammer and put their finger on the trigger. And that's what we're going to be continuing our discussion today about. And lots of soundbite, folks, soundbites. I realize to a certain degree it's kind of a lazy way of doing the program by letting somebody else do your talking for you, but I have found that formulating our argument here in the court of public opinion, that these sound bites are extremely powerful. I suppose in many ways it's similar to the kinds of audiovisual evidence that's used in a courtroom in convicting a person, of convincing the jury and convicting the person. I want to start off today's discussion with a little You know, I've been many times, I've been referred to many things, many times, folks, but one of the many things that I have been referred to is the king of metaphors, you know, that I use metaphorical language in painting a mental picture for people to better understand at least the point that I'm trying to make. And I'm going to do that again today. And the picture I would like to paint for all of you is the following scenario. Imagine that you received a phone call from the local police department, or they sent one of their officers out to your home, and they said, you know, we're sorry to have to tell you this, but one of your loved ones, maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a child, maybe it's a parent, whatever, has been in a terrible car accident, and they're at the hospital. We can't give you any more information than that, which I think basically is an across-the-board real thing, folks. I don't think that police officers are allowed to tell family members the extent of something that's happened. They merely say that an accident has happened, and so-and-so is at the local hospital. Anyway, and imagine you get to the hospital, and you know, you're frantic, and you come in, and you talk to the gal at the front desk, and you say, you know, we just received this call that one of our relatives has been in this accident, and, you know, we need to know more information. So the nice lady behind the desk tells you to go sit down, and the doctor will be out to speak with you. And then, you know, a few minutes later, out comes this doctor who's taking care of your loved one, and he says, hello, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I'm taking care of your loved one here, and I just wanted to let you know that, you know, he was in a car accident. He's alive right now. He suffered a broken leg, and I'll send you in to see him as soon as they have finished taking care of things. And so everybody's relieved because they think that it's not as bad as they had been led to believe that it was, okay? And they're waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, somebody comes out, somebody different, and they say, you can come in and see, you can see your loved one now. And then you go in and you can see your loved one, who you assumed, based upon what the doctor told you, had merely suffered a broken leg. And your loved one is there, strapped up to every type of machine that exists in the hospital to keep this person alive. There's a machine breathing for him. There's a machine beating his heart. He's got tubes and wires coming out of all of him, out of his entire body. And half of his head is missing because he suffered a terrible, in this wreck, he suffered a terrible injury to his head. And the nurse or the doctor explains to you what's going on here, which is that your loved one is basically gone. They're only alive because of the machines keeping him alive. And now it's time for you to make the decision as to whether or not it's time to pull the plug on this, because he's gone. He's never coming back. That's it. And, you know, you're all bewildered because you're saying to yourself, what's the deal here? The doctor, the original doctor we spoke to, told us that he had suffered a broken leg. And we were led to believe that it was a minor thing. And the medical person there says, well, technically speaking, the doctor told you the truth. He did suffer a broken leg. But the truth of the matter is that every bone in his body is broken and all of his organs have shut down. And the only thing keeping him alive right now are these machines. Well, folks, that essentially is the situation in which we find ourselves right now. I realize this is kind of an imperfect metaphor, but I think that it does serve in explaining where we are right now. We have a whole host of people out there who are quote-unquote explaining things to us, doctors, so to speak, and they are telling us things that lead us to believe that it's not as bad as it really is, when in fact the truth is, as I said before, that loaded gun, the hammer has been cocked and the person's finger is on the trigger. And we're that close. It's just that close. And, you know, these people, of course, they occupy positions in our media. Obviously, they occupy positions in our churches, our Christian churches, and even in, sad to say, many Islamic mosques. And for thousands of years now, they have refused to tell us the truth, the ugly truth concerning this religion, this cult religion that the followers of Judaism practice, and particularly with regards to how it all relates to us as Gentiles. Okay. You know, I bring this up, folks, because over the weekend, I was sent an essay that was written by someone that I actually personally know. And this person is, you know, something of a quote-unquote expert, something of a doctor in terms of understanding Judaism and the danger that this particular group of cultists, you know, the danger that they pose to all of us today. And he wrote this article, this essay, dealing with Benjamin Netanyahu's most recent statement that caused quite an uproar within those circles where people follow what's going on in the Middle East, and particularly the giant human sacrifice, black mass, that's taking place right now in Gaza. And this person, despite their expertise, what they said is that Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't know his Bible. He doesn't know his Old Testament. Because what happened is that Netanyahu quoted from both the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Samuel, come from the Old Testament, where it calls upon the followers of Judaism to utterly exterminate Amalek. And this individual wrote this essay saying, Netanyahu doesn't know what he's talking about. Zionism is from the Talmud. The Old Testament doesn't have anything to do with it. This is a I could go on with the particulars of it, folks, but needless to say, it was very unnerving to read these things, because only a person who lives in a state of complete disconnect with reality could make this statement that Zionism and the butchery that is taking place in Gaza right now, and Netanyahu's specifically citing the Old Testament, or the Torah as it's known among the Jews, specifically citing this piece of religious literature, that it all comes from the Talmud. And in many ways, folks, what this is a picture of the metaphor that I just painted for you, involving those whose job is to bring us the ugly truth of the situation, but for whatever reason, they just don't have it within them to do it, like the doctor who comes out. Now, the doctor didn't lie when he said that the loved one had suffered a broken leg. Yeah, he did. Every bone in his body's broken. It's much, much worse than that, though. Okay, it's not just a broken leg. And to lead people down this path of not telling them the truth about how bad the situation is, you're not doing them any favors, because they're going to find out sooner or later anyway. They're going to find out. So it is a very cruel, dishonest, obviously, very cruel, dishonest, and I would say, given the situation that we're all dealing with right now, folks, I would say an inhumane thing to try and sugarcoat or otherwise confuse people today, especially those people right now who have got that loaded gun pointed to their heads. And I'm talking about all of us, folks, because what is happening in Gaza, the people who are doing this, who are officiating and participating in this giant black mass of human sacrifice, they're going to do it to us. In fact, we, in the West at least, we are the real targets of this. Yes, right now they're talking about Hamas and they're, you know, relating it to ISIS. But as we discussed on the last program, the followers of Judaism are not commanded to wipe out Ishmael, which are the Arabs and the Persians and the Turks. They are, however, commanded to wipe out the descendants of Esau, known as Amalek, or Amalek, as this one horrible rabbi you heard on last week's program and that you're going to be hearing again today. They are ordered to wipe them out, okay? And that's, you know, for those of you listening to this program who happen to be living in the West, and whether it's Europe, whether it's America, that's us, folks. That's us. They see us as the modern-day descendants of the same Romans that destroyed their Temple of Doom 2,000 years ago, and they are on a mission. They are on a mission to move heaven, hell, and everything in between in order to destroy us. And this war that has opened up against Hamas in Gaza is just the shot, that's just the shot heard around the world that is going to start this. Okay. So, we owe it, we are owed by those who would presume to be the emergency room doctors who come out and tell us, you know, what's going on and what we, you know, need to do, how we need to prepare ourselves for what's coming. We are owed the truth, no matter how horrible that truth may be. Okay? We are owed it simply so that we can brace ourselves for what is coming. And those, as I said, folks, those who otherwise, who we have entrusted to tell us the truth, like these doctors, who don't, who confuse us and, you know, for whatever reasons, because, you know, they happen to hold certain religious or emotional ideas that prevent them from going into certain areas and involving themselves in what I would refer to as full disclosure of things. Either way, folks, they're doing us a great disservice. Okay. And that's what this program is about. It's what it's always been about. That's why we call it the ugly truth, because it's that truth that nobody wants to look at, nobody wants to consider. You know, no different than the family members who are traveling to the hospital. They don't want to hear that their loved one is basically gone for all intents and purposes. They want to hear something. Okay, it's not necessarily great news. Okay, but it's not horrible news. It's not terminal news. Okay, you can live with a broken leg, meaning a loved one who has suffered a broken leg. But learning the awful truth that your loved one is gone is a different matter altogether. Anyway, having said that, folks, we're going to go ahead and jump right into today's program. Now, in order to get this thing started off on the right foot, we are going to, as I said, we will be using quite a few sound bites today, folks, because they are of monumental importance in order for us to fully understand what it is that we're dealing with. So we're going to start off today's discussion with some quotes from the Bible, folks, from the Old Testament, because this is what is driving all of this business. It is the Old Testament. It is the Torah, whatever words we want to use in describing it. The Talmud, yes, it does play a part, but again, folks, we have to understand what the Talmud is. The Talmud is just an extension of that same Old Testament, that same Torah, okay? It's this expanded edition of it, where the particulars of how all of the things that have been laid out within the pages of the Old Testament or Torah, how they are to be implemented. So we're going to start off with three quotes here. And the first one comes from the book of Obadiah, which technically speaking is not the Torah, folks. The Torah is the first five books of the Old Testament that are attributed to Moses writing them. The book of Obadiah is that book that follows after, but is within the same Old Testament, and it is considered one of the prophetic books. It's one of these books which the followers of Judaism, whether we want to call them Hebrews, Israelites, Judites, Judeans, Jews, whatever, they all mean the same thing. It's one of these books, one of the prophetic books, that they use in charting their course for what it is that they are trying to do today. Okay, because with them, everything is about this book and what it says. Now, from the book of Obadiah, what we read is the following, quote, "On Mount Zion there will be deliverance, and the house of Jacob will reclaim its possession. Then the house of Jacob will be a blazing fire, and the house of Joseph a burning flame, and the house of Esau will be reduced to mere stubble. For Jacob will set it ablaze and consume it, and no survivor will remain from the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken." Now, folks, remember, going back to last week's program, Esau is today's West, and we're going to be replaying that soundbite from last week's program where you've got these rabbis, these horrible rabbis, who are explaining, you know, in modern day terms, what this cryptic character known as Amalek is. And they make it very, very clear, crystal clear, in fact, that Amalek is not just this group of people that lived thousands of years ago. It is the people today who are the great-great-grandchildren of yesteryear's Roman Empire that destroyed the Second Temple and scattered the Jews to the four corners of what was the empire at that time, and which has to be destroyed. And, you know, as we've pointed out many times, folks, most of the major yearly celebrations that the followers of Judaism celebrate, they're all dedicated to the destruction of people who in some way harmed, offended, or got sideways with Yahweh's chosen, meaning the Hebrews, the Israelites, Judeans, Jews, whatever. We have Passover that celebrates the destruction of Egypt. We have Purim that celebrates the destruction of Persia. We have Hanukkah, or Hanukkah, as Mike Piper used to disparagingly refer to it, that celebrates the destruction of Greece and Syria. We don't have, there aren't any celebrations for the destruction of Rome, okay, because technically speaking, it hasn't happened yet, okay? They're building up to that. That is what all of this is about. And so when they talk about setting a flame burning to stubble, okay, let's just look at this quote again from the book of Obadiah. "On Mount Zion there will be deliverance, and the house of Jacob will reclaim its possession." What is that possession, folks? Well, it's the Holy Land. It's the Promised Land. It's all of that land between the Nile and the Euphrates rivers that the Jews believe, the followers of Judaism believe, was gifted to them by their God. And that appears not in the Talmud, folks. It appears literally within the first book of the Torah, the book of Genesis. And they have been striving for this ever since, this Nile to the Euphrates Empire. But they have been stopped and they have been frustrated by several things. Number one, the fact that they were, quote unquote, slaves in Egypt, which I don't believe ever happened, folks. But nevertheless, they believe that it happened. And that's all that matters, is that they believe in it. So they were frustrated from that. Then they're freed from Egypt, and then they begin the process of claiming their inheritance. Okay. And with that, you know, you read in the Old Testament, especially the book of Joshua, how they went in and slaughtered every living thing that existed, everything that they came in contact with. The Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, all the names given to these various tribes of people who were living very peaceably in the Holy Land. And they went in and slaughtered all of them. Okay. Then comes along Alexander the Great, okay, the Greek conqueror. And he put a stop to this. Put a stop to this. And said, that's it, no more of this. Because what was happening, of course, is that Alexander and the Greeks, that they were moving eastward, expanding their influence, bringing Greek culture to the region. And a small group of terrorist, religious terrorist Jews, known as the Maccabees, rose up against this And as they say, they defeated the Greek Empire. I doubt that that really happened, folks, but it, like I said, it doesn't matter whether or not it really did happen. What matters is that they believe it. And out of this, they get their celebration of Hanukkah. Okay. And then we have the Persians. Okay, so the Persians basically have done the same thing. They have restrained these religious terrorists from terrorizing the peoples that were within the Persian Empire, spreading out and slaughtering anybody who doesn't see things the way that the followers of Judaism see it. And so then they have, as a result of this, you know, they rise up against the Persian Empire as they believe it, and they slaughter 75,000 Persians, and they have their celebration of Purim. And then the Romans come in, folks, and they do the same thing. They restrain them. They stop them from expanding to, you know, from the Nile to the Euphrates rivers, this whole, you know, this entire paradigm that exists within the Old Testament or Torah. But this time, you know, rather than it just being a few generations or a few hundred years of their plans being interrupted, it lasts for 2,000 years. So what this calls for, folks, obviously, is a massive act of retaliation, massive, something that is going to teach the whole world the bitter lesson of what happens when you get sideways with Yahweh's chosen people. And this is what they're in the process of doing now. So when they talk about the house of Jacob, meaning, you know, remember, folks, we have to go back and remember last week's program where we were talking about Jacob and Esau, how Jacob robbed Esau of his inheritance. And as a result of this, this is where the bad blood between Esau and Jacob began. So when they talk about Jacob reclaiming his possession and setting the house of Esau on fire and reducing it to mere stubble, that's Israel and the Jewish people destroying today's Roman Empire. Okay, let's go on to our next quote. Let's see. On that day, I will make the clans of Judah like a firepot in a woodpile, like a flaming torch among the sheaves. They will consume all of the peoples around them, on the right and on the left, while the people of Jerusalem remain secure. And on that day, I will set out to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now, folks, and this, by the way, comes from the book of Zechariah. Okay? Now, we have to remember here that you have to read, just like any contract, you have to read it very carefully. Any kind of legal document, you have to read everything very carefully, especially the fine print. Now, when they talk about all of the nations that come against Jerusalem, the first thing that comes to our minds as Gentiles, because Gentiles, by their nature, they try to see things in very practical ways by looking at things in a very surface level manner. That's not the way that the Jewish brain works, folks. Okay, the Jewish brain is consumed with details, minor details. This is what the Talmud is all about. It is a book full of details. Okay, for example, as I pointed out on this program before, there was this, years ago, there was this huge debate that took place amongst this great group of rabbis in Israel about whether or not a religiously devout Jew could pick his or her nose on the Sabbath. Now, everybody knows, sorry, folks, I'm sorry to have to bring up such a topic as this, especially this early in the morning, for those of you maybe who haven't had breakfast yet. But yeah, they had this debate, a group of rabbis had this debate on whether or not it was permitted for Jews to pick their nose on the Sabbath. Now, what's the crux, what's the bone of contention here? Okay, so folks, the Torah specifies that one of the things you're not allowed to do on the Sabbath is to cut your hair. Now, I'm sorry, folks. I really am. I'm going to have to get a little bit graphic here. But, you know, in your nostrils, you've got hairs, okay? And, you know, somebody picking their nose off, it's possible maybe that you'll yank some hairs out with it, okay? So these Jews got together, these rabbis got together and debated whether or not it was permissible for a Jew to pick his or her nose. Let's be very egalitarian about this, folks, okay? Men and women alike, whether or not they can pick their nose on the Sabbath, and it was decided that no, they cannot. They cannot pick their nose on the Sabbath because the possibility exists that while they're picking their noses, they may pull out some hair, which would constitute as the equivalent of cutting your hair, which you're not allowed to do on the Sabbath. Okay. That's just one example, folks. We could go on for 1,000 years talking about the various discussions. You know, we posted one on the website sometime last year where a question was posed to this rabbi, this horrible, stinking rabbi in Israel. And by the way, folks, just like I said on the last program, it is perfectly appropriate for me as a follower of Jesus Christ to refer to the rabbis as stinking, using that adjective, because Jesus himself said that they were like graves full of dead men's bones. And that there's certainly nothing pleasant about, you know, the odor that is produced with decaying flesh. Anyway, there was a story that was posted on the website, I think last year, where this rabbi was asked by some of his students whether or not the prohibition still existed for Jews not to eat meat, cooked meat, and fish together because it caused leprosy. So this rabbi, who is a rabbi of significant influence in Israel right now, folks, he concluded that even though medical science may have seemed to have proven that eating meat and fish together did not produce leprosy, nevertheless, what do the doctors know? This is Jewish law, and we have to stick with Jewish law. Jewish law says you shouldn't eat meat with fish because it causes leprosy. Okay, now, folks, the reason I bring that up is to point out a very important protocol that we as Gentiles need to understand about how the Jewish brain works, which is that the Jewish brain is very, very detail-oriented. It is very nitty-gritty. It focuses on the minutiae of things. Okay, whereas the rest of us living in the 21st century AD, we focus on the big picture. The Jews, however, being stuck in the 21st century BC, they focus on the smaller picture. So when, getting back to our quote here from the book of Zechariah, when they're talking about those nations who come against Jerusalem, we get in our mind this notion of armies, tanks, and all of the rest of them coming in to move militarily against Jerusalem. That's not how the Jews see it, folks. Okay? When a U.S. president or when any other world, Gentile world leader talks about Jerusalem being a city for all of the quote unquote Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. That is just as much an assault, a military assault against the city of Jerusalem as if tanks and soldiers and planes and all of the rest of them were being put into force, okay? So those nations, including the United States, folks, okay, who are talking about peace deals where Jerusalem will be utilized as a common city, an international city for all people, okay, rather than as the headquarters of the state of Israel, from which all rules governing all human behavior worldwide will reside. That's the equivalent of it. So when Zechariah, according to this prophecy, is talking about, I will set out to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. That means simply for a United States president talking about a peace deal in the Middle East with a Palestinian capital in part of the city of Jerusalem, such as what Trump was trying to do. Now, folks, let's see, where are we on the program here? This is going to be a long one. This is going to be, oh my goodness, we're already at 35 minutes. Okay. Yeah, it's going to be long, folks. It's going to be long. It's going to be somewhat tedious. I'm sure we'll be able to get through it, though. Okay. Now, as I said, Netanyahu made this statement this past week talking about destroying Amalek. And we will be listening to that in just a moment. Before we do that, though, folks, our first soundbite of the day was sent to me by one of our listeners, one of our readers, and he sent it. He sent it to the Oracle of Idaho. This is what he calls me now, the Oracle of Idaho, as if I were some type of prophet, which I'm not, folks. Like I've told many people, what I do here is RFS. Real freaking simple. All you have to do is remember the simple rules of mathematics, 2 + 2 = 4. And as long as you remember those rules, you can take any equation with any number of numbers on each side, and you can come up with the right answer. 2 + 2 = 4. 22 + 22 = 44. 222 + 222 = 444. Okay. The rule stays the same. The fact that it becomes, that the equation becomes longer and longer, is immaterial. And so the things that we have figured out here does not mean that I am an oracle, a prophet, a soothsayer, or anything like that, folks. It's really simple. We're going to start off today's discussion here, folks, with a soundbite that my good friend sent me, and where he said that we have been vindicated on the website with what we have said about Donald Trump and why it was and why it is that Judea Incorporated, and especially the person of Netanyahu, has moved heaven, hell, and everything in between in order to destroy Trump so that he could not finish what it was he intended to do with regards to quote-unquote, coming against Jerusalem by creating a Palestinian state. So let's listen to this, folks.
It's going to have to do with both sides, but a lot will have to do with Israel and whether or not Israel wants to make the deal. As far as settlements, I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit. We'll work something out, but I would like to see a deal be made. It might be a bigger and better deal than people in this room even understand. That's a possibility. So let's see what we do. Doesn't sound too optimistic, but that's...
I was disappointed in BB, just on a personal basis. I thought he wanted to make a deal more than Netanyahu. And I will be honest, I had a great meeting with him, Abbas, right? I had a great meeting with him, and we spent a lot of time together, talked about many things. And it was almost like a father. I mean, you know, he was so nice. Couldn't have been nicer. And after meeting with Bibi for 3 minutes, I looked at him and said, you don't want to make a deal, do you? And he said, well, and the fact is, I don't think Bibi ever wanted to make a deal.
Okay, folks, that was Donald Trump. And these, I can tell by listening to it because I've heard these before. Whoever put together this collection of quotes of him, he's talking with Barak Ravid, the Israeli journalist who wrote this book entitled Trump's Peace, which again, folks, I really cannot recommend strongly enough that you go out and get a hold of, because you will be able to see reading what it is that Ravid writes, exactly why the world and especially the United States for the last 7 years has been subjected to everything that it has been with regards to Trump. All of the political turmoil here in the United States, the release of COVID, which came from, now Ravid doesn't say this, folks, but, you know, let's, when we go down the list and we start asking questions, okay, who benefited the most from, the release of this virus? It's obvious what happened, who benefited the most from it, because Trump was removed from office before he could put the final touches on this peace deal. So let's see, when Trump is talking about making a bigger and better deal than most people realize, what he's talking about, folks, is avoiding World War III and Armageddon, which we are watching unfold now in real time. As we said on the program here a couple of weeks ago, right after the slaughter began, literally almost, well, it'll be a month tomorrow. This was Netanyahu's October surprise. You know, here in the United States, this is a common saying that we have every year during an election year, that in October, which is a month right before the elections, something big happens that one party does to try and get the upper hand on the elections in their favor. And that is exactly what this war in the Middle East is all about, folks. This was Netanyahu's October surprise. It's just that he did it a year early. And he's doing this in order to prevent Trump from doing what he intends to do if and when he does manage to win and to take the White House. Okay. I was having a conversation with actually one of my kids. We were talking about all this business. And I was going down the list of all the presidents that have tried to do what Trump almost succeeded in doing. Every president, beginning with JFK, who dared to put a cage around this wild animal in the Middle East known as the Jewish state, they all paid for it to some degree. Okay, obviously, JFK was murdered for it. Nixon, he was just about to put the squeeze on Israel and to push for the creation of a Palestinian state. And then we saw what happened with Watergate and his being forced to resign. Ford, who took over after Nixon, immediately picked up that baton and started his own program for creating this Palestinian state, and even went so far as to withhold for 6 months all of that financing that the United States gives to the Jewish state, to the tune right now, folks, and that's before the passage of this upcoming bill that's going to increase it to almost $20 billion, I think. Ford went so far as to withhold all aid to Israel for 6 months while the U.S. government, quote-unquote, reassessed its position. And it was because of Ford's insistence upon finishing what Nixon started in creating this Palestinian state. Ford was rewarded with two assassination attempts within the span of only 2 weeks. Both of them failed. And then not being reelected. Carter takes over after Ford, and he actually does move forward with this, and he creates the Camp David peace agreement that forced Israel to give back the Sinai Desert to Egypt that Israel stole during the 1967 war, an agreement that Menachem Begin, who Carter himself referred to as psychotic, opposed with every fiber of his being. And then, what do you know, folks? All of a sudden, we have hostages being taken in Iran. The rescue mission to retrieve these hostages goes down in flames. Literally, we lose, I think, about a dozen soldiers in what was known as Operation Eagle Claw. The economy totally goes south. Everything is miserable, and we know, folks, we know that this is a major tool that the organized Jewish interests in America and really throughout the West, who own the banking and the financial systems of the West, that they employ. And then this paved the way for Reagan to come into office. As soon as Reagan comes into office, he immediately gets to work with the business of trying to create a Palestinian state. And then all of a sudden, we have these horrible events taking place. We have the Sabra and Shatila massacre that was done deliberately in order to drive a wedge between Reagan and the Arabs in the Middle East. We had the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, and then we had throughout the almost the entirety of Reagan's two terms, we had the shadow of Iran-Contra hanging over him all the time. So he wasn't able to move forward with his plans for a peace deal. Then you had George H.W. Bush, who, yes, he officiated, he commanded the invasion of Iraq. He stopped short of doing what it was that the Israeli lobby wanted him to do, meaning that was supposed to be the spark that set the entire Middle East on fire. So not only did he not finish the job he was supposed to do, but he also used his popularity in the United States. He was the most popular president in U.S. history, folks. His approval ratings were in the 90 degree percentile after the end of Desert Storm. And he used that huge political capital and support from the American people to pressure Israel into participating in the Madrid peace conference that he had put together, while at the same time withholding $10 billion of aid from Israel. So what happens to George H.W. Bush? He goes from being the most popular president in American history to having the economy collapse out from under him, and then this slick talker from Arkansas, Bill Clinton, gets elected. Bill Clinton immediately goes to work with creating this peace deal, and he actually succeeds, you know, because it's under Clinton, not only that we saw the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan take place, but we also saw the creation of the Palestinian Authority, which is the embryonic, the beginning stages of creating this Palestinian state. And what do you know? Bill Clinton finds himself in the middle of a huge scandal because of his carrying on with this Jewish girl named Monica Lewinsky, an intern in the White House. He finds himself being impeached, and he can't finish what he intended to do. And believe me, folks, like I've said before, I'm not singing the praises of Bill Clinton. I hated Bill Clinton then. I hate him now. But nevertheless, we have to look at this in a very cold and analytical way. Bill Clinton did bring some modicum of peace to the Middle East. He created the embryonic stages of a Palestinian state with the peace agreements that he pushed forward, and which Benjamin Netanyahu at the time very, very loudly and clearly said was a big mistake and that Israel was never going to abide by these things. Netanyahu was so despised in Washington, folks, that during the previous term, George H.W. Bush's term, Netanyahu, who was Israel's ambassador to the UN, was personally barred from ever coming into the State Department building by the Secretary of State himself, James Baker. So we have Clinton, and then we have George W. Bush, the little monkey. And again, folks, I have no love for him at all. I never thought I would hate anybody as much as I hated Bill Clinton, but George W. Bush proved me wrong. George W. Bush was going to pick up where his father left off, and he was about to announce on the floor at the UN General Assembly, that's September of 2001, he was going to announce that it would be his administration's goal to create a Palestinian state. First president since the whole business in the Middle East started, folks, who was going to say this publicly. He didn't get to do that, folks, because the next day, before he had announced to his Secretary of State, Colin Powell, that this was what they were going to talk about at the UN, that was September the 10th. September the 11th happened, and there was no more talk of a Palestinian state. Now we have Donald Trump, who is the deal maker, who can't be bribed or bullied or blackmailed. And of all the presidents, folks, that have frightened Israel and frightened especially Netanyahu and his party of terrorists known as Likud, it was Donald Trump, because they knew that this guy, everything that he touched turned to gold. Okay, he didn't build this business empire in Manhattan by being a fool. Okay, he's very competent, he's very driven, and he's a deal maker. Out of all the presidents, he's the one that they feared the most. And that is why they went to the lengths that they did in order to stop him from doing what he was planning to do. Now, I have to bring this up, folks, because unfortunately, you know, it has been this narrative within the pro-Palestinian anti-Zionist community now, ever since Trump was running for office, that he was a tool of the Jews, that Netanyahu and he were the best of friends, and that Netanyahu and Israel put Trump into office in order to get World War III started. And none of this, folks, none of this has an ounce of truth to it. It's total BS. It is total bunk. And you don't have to be a prophet or an oracle or a soothsayer to figure this out. It was apparent from the very beginning when Trump announced that he was running for president that the same groups, the same individuals who pushed for war against Iraq and got what they wanted, pushed for the clash of civilizations between Islam and Christianity and who got what they wanted, it was the same individuals and groups who now were moving heaven and hell and everything in between in order to destroy Donald Trump. People like Bill Kristol, Charles Krauthammer, Jennifer Rubin, let's see, the two portly Kagan brothers, that same network, folks, of neocons, okay? Now, I bring this up because, you know, Trump has made a few statements on Gaza and about Hamas, and he, of course, has been talking tough on it. But again, folks, we have to remember that he understands the terrain on which he is operating, that he's dealing with these insane Christian Zionist evangelicals who love the fact that Israel has mass murdered as many as 10,000 people now in the last 4 weeks. Think that this is wonderful. And they happen to be his biggest base of support. So there are certain things that he simply has to say, that he has no choice but to talk tough on them, just like he talked tough about Iran. But he knows where all of this is going, folks. And so when he was talking about, you know, a bigger deal than anyone in this room, I think is what he said, could possibly imagine, that deal that he was talking about was avoiding exactly the situation that all of us are facing right now. Now, I know we're kind of bouncing around very quickly, folks, between some very heavy topics, but I'm going to get into now this discussion or this business of Netanyahu, you know, referencing Amalek and why it is so important to us right now. I mean, obviously, it's important to the people of Gaza, who have lost 10,000 people now in the last 4 weeks. But it actually is much bigger than that. And as we are about to listen to this soundbite, I want you to remember, folks, remember back in 2012, I think it was, when Netanyahu was speaking at the UN General Assembly, and he held up that bomb cartoon, what was referred to by everybody as the bomb cartoon. And he used this red marker, you know, and he drew this line up near the top where the fuse was. Okay. And I think there were some numbers on it, like 90%, something like that. And what he was specifically in talking about was how, you know, Iran is developing nuclear weapons and they're just about at the point of where they have reached breakout capability, and how we got to do something about this now. But what he was really doing, folks, is that he was threatening all of the leaders of the world, and especially the United States, because this was during the administration of Obama, and Obama had negotiated this deal with the Iranians that the U.S. was going to unfreeze billions of dollars of money that, yes, folks, that the United States stole from Iran, in return for which Iran was going to cooperate with inspectors and making sure that Iran was abiding by certain terms, that she wouldn't purify or enrich uranium, you know, up to weapons grade level. Netanyahu wasn't talking about that bomb he was holding was not an Iranian nuclear weapon, but an Israeli one, folks. That's what it was all about. And nobody got it right. Everybody around the world, all of the media outlets, pro-Palestinian, anti-Zionist, even, you know, I mean, all of them, they were all laughing about this, saying, look at this fool, look at what he's doing up here. And they didn't understand that what he was really doing was threatening to incinerate the entire world if Israel didn't get what she wanted, which was the United States going to war against Iran in the same way that the United States destroyed Iraq. Well, the same thing has happened just in the last, since we were last together, folks. Netanyahu gave this speech in the horrible language of Hebrew that you're going to hear in just a moment with a translator reading over him, where he's talking about the massacre going on in Gaza at present and how this is what the Jews, the Hebrews, are commanded to do. They are commanded to exterminate Amalek, or however we want to describe it. And, you know, you had media outlets, pro-Palestinian outlets, saying, look at this, he's invoking the Bible to justify what's happening. Well, of course, folks, why wouldn't he? It's right there. It's in the Bible. So we're going to listen to this here, and then I'm going to be pausing it in between to offer some commentary. So let's just listen here for a moment.
You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. And we do remember, and we are fighting our brave troops and combatants who are now in Gaza or around Gaza and in all other regions in Israel are joining this chain of Jewish heroes, a chain that has started 3,000 years ago from Joshua ben Nun until the heroes of 1948, the Six-Day War, the 73 October War, and all other wars in this country. Our hero troops, they have one supreme main goal: to completely defeat the murderous enemy and to guarantee our existence in this country. We've always said, never again. Never again is now.
Okay, folks, so that was Netanyahu invoking the commandment for the followers of Judaism to remember what Amalek has done and to wipe them off the face of the earth, even down to the suckling child, folks. And Netanyahu says that this is a continuation, this is a chain. Okay, think about a chain, folks. You know, all of these little links that are joined together, it can be a foot long, it can be 100 feet long, okay, but it's one unit, one piece. And he says it is a 3,000-year-old chain going all the way back to Joshua. Okay, now that's Joshua in the Old Testament, folks, not Joshua in the Talmud, as certain experts, you know, want to divert your attention into thinking. Okay, Netanyahu is absolutely right, and it is perfectly appropriate for him as a Jew to cite Joshua and the Book of Deuteronomy and the Book of Samuel in calling the people of Gaza Amalek. And why it is, it's not just permissible, folks, it's not just permitted, why they are commanded to kill even the suckling children. Okay, as an aside, folks, can you all imagine the noise that we would be hearing in the aftermath of this attack on the part of Hamas against Israel, if they were able to find some passage of the Quran that said, go in and slaughter everything that lives, even down to the suckling child? Can you imagine what we would be hearing? I can guarantee you, folks, I can absolutely guarantee you that across the English-speaking world this past weekend, at least in those Protestant churches that, you know, where the people in there worship the Jewish people and worship the Jewish state more than they worship Jesus Christ himself, I can guarantee you that there was a hell of a lot of discussion taking place in those churches where they were saying, Netanyahu is such a godly man. You know, he's a good Jew. He's not like these Jews like, Josh Rogan. What is that guy's name? That horrible Josh Rogan. You know, the actor. Sarah Silverman, Woody Allen. He's a good biblical Jew. Look, he's quoting the Bible here. He's quoting Deuteronomy and he's quoting, the book of Samuel. I guarantee you, folks, some discussion of that type is exactly what took place across tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of churches in the English-speaking world where this cancer of Christian Zionism exists. Now, folks, the reason why what Netanyahu said is so important, it's not just that he is using Judaism itself, Torah Judaism, and the Old Testament to justify what they are doing right now in absolutely slaughtering these innocent people in Gaza. Okay? We have to remember who Amalek is, folks. Okay? And to remind you of who Amalek is. And I apologize, you know, for this long soundbite that you're going to be listening to, but you have to remember, just like when Netanyahu held up that cartoon at the UN of the bomb that's about to explode, and nobody understood what he was really saying here, which is that he was threatening to incinerate, just as Jewish prophecy says is going to happen to the West. Okay, that the house of Jacob is going to set the house of Esau on fire and that none of Esau's descendants are going to live through it. Likewise, when Netanyahu is using the teachings, the commandment to exterminate Amalek, he's using that in conjunction with an association with what he's doing right now in Gaza, okay? You have to remember, folks, who Amalek really is. And in order for us to get a better handle on that, we're going to be sitting down and listening to some of the sound bites that we were listening to on the last program. So please bear with me.
In the book of Exodus and also in the book of Deuteronomy, we speak about the mitzvah to destroy and to annihilate the nation of Amalek. Says the Rambam in mitzvah 188 and also 189 and also in negative commandment 59 that there's a mitzvah and a command to wipe out from among all the descendants of Esav, the descendants of Amalek, male and female, young and old.
Esav, who is the symbol of all the nations, Christians or not.
Esav, who in modern day terms is really basically, 31 of them is America.
What's the difference between Edom and Amalek? We spoke about Edom being the grandfather of Amalek. Amalek is Germany, so who's Edom? Edom includes most of Europe. It includes the United States of America. It's the Roman Empire that was never destroyed. But for those who don't understand that Italy is the seat of the Roman Empire, of Edom, even though Edom is scattered, many other nations today that speak Latin languages, that have something of the Roman Empire, including America, they are first. So Edom is everywhere, and the United States of America is also part of Edom.
It all started, of course, with Esav. Esav became Edom, which is a nation. Edom became Rome. The Torah says Esav is Edom. The Gemara says, the Talmud says, that Rome, that Edom is Rome, Zuroimi.
Edom becomes America. Why? Because America is Edom, after all.
as our sages said, Halakha hi, Esav sone le Yaakov. It is a law of nature that Esav will always hate the Jewish people. Will hate Jacob. Jacob is the Jewish people. And Esav is the non-Jewish world.
In Isaiah chapter 63, the day of the great and terrible day of the Lord, it says that the Lord will come out from a place called Edom and he will crush Edom. Now, I'm just a broadcaster here, okay? In Jewish understanding, Edom is really talking about the Christianity.
Who is Amalek? Amalek is Reshit Goim. The Jews were so revered by the entire world when they came out of Egypt. But when Amalek, which is the grandchild of Esav, Yaakov's brother, saw them, Amalek came and attacked the Jews. And therefore God commands us that we should never forget this. This is why the most important Torah reading of the year is Zachor. God commands Moses to tell Yahushua that he must annihilate Amalek. And this battle between Amalek, good and evil, goes from generation to generation. So Amalek, we know Hitler and Haman and all of those other gang of people that wanted to annihilate the Jews are part of this terrible gang. Because Amalek is darkness. They're the antithesis to godliness and holiness. Everything the Jewish nation stands for, if the Jewish nation stands for humility, godliness, light, they are darkness. And we are commanded to destroy this because Amalek is not only a physical nation, it's a spiritual energy. It's a negative force of darkness.
It's mitzvah from the Torah, one of the 613 commandments, is to remember to erase the nation of Amalek, the memory of them even, not only physically to erase them from the face of the earth. Anything that reminds us about them is mitzvah to dismiss and to erase it from the face of the earth. Hashem said to King Shaul, now it's time to destroy Amalek. Don't leave one survivor. Destroy the entire nation of Amalek with their animals, everything that is owned by them. No Jews are allowed to enjoy from it. Do not leave any memory from them. Hashem said, do not have mercy on the children. Kill all their children also. Why? There's no difference between them and their children. In 10 years from now, these children will attack you on the way. Hashem knows, God knows. You kill all men and all women. Me'olel ve'ad yonek. Even babies who breastfeed. Amazing. Mishor ve'atzeh. All axes, all goats, camels, donkeys. Don't leave anything, any memory from this filthy nation.
Why are the nations, why are the Goyim, the idol worshippers, why are they mezo'amim? What's mezo'amim? Mezo'amim means they're impure. Their natural state is being impure. A Goy's natural state is impurity.
Erase the name of Amalek. Do not forget. We assume that anyway, every enemy of Israel, every anti-Semite, stems from the seed of Amalek.
This is what Hashem said. Pakadeti et asher asa Amalek li Israel. The nature of this nation, Amalek, we don't know who Amalek is. We assume that it's the Germans, after we see what they did in the Holocaust, not only to the Jews, to the whole world. And it's not only the Germans, it's most of the European countries. That's where Amalek is.
As a people blessed with a long memory, we as Jews summon sacred texts and ancient histories to guide us in times of uncertainty. Yes, the situation today is frightful, but no, it is not unprecedented. In America today, we have white supremacy. In the Torah, we had Amalek. Blotting out the memory of Amalek is a military command, literally to destroy Amalek. Now, seeing today's Amalek, we are reminded that the Torah calls us not just to escape, but to extirpate Amalek. We are commanded to do real and literal battle against it. That means coming off the bench in the fight against white supremacy. means putting our reputations and our money, our physical bodies on the line.
The descendants of the enemies of our people that were enemies to our people from day first are still hating us in the commandment of their ancestors, the children of Esav that hates Yaakov, the children of Amalek that hates Yaakov, the children of all the ones that had that black bitterness instead of a soul, that black, dark, horrible, depressed, negative, and awful shadow as a poor replacement for a soul, still hating us, still jealous, still don't know what to do with our goodness.
For all you anti-Semites out there, your day is gone. And if you decide to become an open group of anti-Semites, your days will be numbered. Someone from the Jewish special forces will take you out, just like they take out hundreds of Muslim criminals, hundreds of jihadists each year. They'll take you out as well.
The Torah says that people who worship idols such as yourself, when there is a Sanhedrin,
to kill us.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the Torah
says. So we know how the Jewish people feel about Christians, yes? That you discriminate against Christians.
Christians are idol
worshippers. You discriminate against Christians.
The Torah says that Christianity is idol worship.
Let me ask you.
You worship three gods.
Let me ask.
Well, what's the punishment if you transgress the Noahide laws? Death. Now, technically speaking, I see anyone in a church, you know, and they're bowing down, they're a non-Jew, I can shoot them. Not a problem.
Asking what's going to be with the Goyim when Mashiach comes. Will they be destroyed and annihilated? Someone asks, who cares? Okay. As a nation, they'll cease to exist, even as individuals. Every individual, no survivors. Not only as a nation, they'll cease to exist, even as individuals. As Goyim, they're gone. Their personality, as they exist, as they would exist independently of Klal Yisrael, they don't exist. They're done. In modern terminology, they call it cultural genocide. There's a term for it by the progressives. It's called cultural genocide. And Itaki used the word genocide. So that's the opinion who says that they'll be annihilated. They basically learn there's going to be cultural genocide. And you know what? The goyim as they exist as goyim b'fnei atzmam, that's done with.
Okay, folks, sorry to have to subject you to that that rather elongated collection of quotes, but you got to know this in order to understand what Netanyahu just recently did. Okay, on the surface, everybody thinks that he's talking about the war against Hamas. But that's not the truth, okay? It's the war against all of us, you see, but it's just starting now, at least the hot part of that war is starting with what is happening with Hamas. Now, I've gotten a couple of emails from some readers and listeners. They have run across this video that Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, gave, where he said that what's going to happen here is that the United States and Europe, that they've had enough of Israel and that they're allowing Israel to go to these excesses in killing all of these innocent people in order to isolate Israel internationally and in order to bring so much pressure on the Jewish state that the Jewish state will be forced to come to terms with the Palestinian situation and to create this Palestinian state. Well, I saw the video, folks, and, you know, Scott Ritter, he's very intelligent. He knows his material. He makes a very good case, but he's leaving out huge gaps of irreconcilable information involved in this, you know. And, you know, the notion that, first of all, that Israel didn't know that this attack was coming, is simply not possible, folks. I'm sorry, it's just not possible. Even former members of the IDF are coming out and saying, look, you know, when anything approaches that fence, you know, something as small as a cat, we've got security teams on their way to that exact location within seconds. Okay, so the notion that that they would be able to do this, that Hamas would be able to do this, and I know a lot of people want to believe that, folks. They want to believe that this was something that was, you know, that this was the result of superior planning and tactics. I'm sorry, folks. I just don't buy it. I don't. I know that the Jews are not omnipotent. They're not, you know. I understand that they make tactical errors, but not many. And something like this, people want to see this as, especially the pro-Palestinian types, they want to see this as, well, they're basically looking at this in the same way that they looked at the Arab Spring when it began. They didn't see that the Arab Spring, yes, the anger on the streets with the peoples in Egypt and Tunisia and other places, that's genuine anger. But the fact that it all erupted at once and that somehow the West didn't know that it was coming is just not possible. It's not possible. So, you know, we are moving forward with the understanding, folks, that Netanyahu and Israel knew that this was coming. They allowed it to happen. This is what they wanted to have happen. And that they did this, that this is the spark that they are going to use in literally burning down the house of Esau, as you just heard. It starts with the Arabs and with the Persians and with the Turks, but it's going to finish with the house of Esau. Now, there was another quote that Netanyahu has given. Both of these things that he did, they were addresses to the nation. That's why he's speaking in that horrible, diabolical Hebrew that he spoke in. He gave another address where he references the prophecy of Isaiah. Okay. And, I want to touch on this because, and then you heard one of these insane, Hebrews talking on that sound bite that I just played where he talks about the prophecy of Isaiah. Okay. And how Isaiah prophesies that this warlord who the Jews are waiting for, their Moshiach, okay, their Messiah, that he's going to come from Edom after having just destroyed it. And remember, folks, what is Edom? Edom is the territory where Esau set up his kingdom. And they, in their minds, whether it's historically real or not, folks, it doesn't matter. We have to remember, what matters is what they believe. You know, like somebody who's in the middle of an acid trip who thinks that he's being chased by a bunch of giant spiders. Okay, the fact that he isn't, okay, he just finds himself in the middle of some city someplace surrounded by people. The fact, and then, you know, he pulls out a weapon and he starts assaulting people because he believes that there are these giant spiders who are attacking him. The fact that he's in the middle of an acid trip, the fact that these people are not giant spiders doesn't mean anything. What matters is what he believes. And so when the Jews believe that the people of Europe, especially, are the descendants of Esau, and that they've been commanded to destroy them, and that their Moshiach is going to be the one who brings this vengeance about, we need to pay attention. So we're going to be listening now to Netanyahu and his talking about, let's see, where is it? Yeah, Isaiah, the prophecy of Isaiah. So let's listen to this for just a moment, folks.
We are in the midst of a war over our existence. We set two goals for this war: to wipe out Hamas by eradicating both its military and governmental capabilities, and to do anything and everything possible in order to bring our hostages back home. All Hamas activists must die above the ground, beneath the ground, inside Gaza, and outside of Gaza. Together with Minister of Defense Gallant, the Minister Benny Gantz, the Security Cabinet, Chief of General Staff, and the heads of the security forces, we are working around the clock in order to carry out and execute the goals of our war until victory. And we do so without any political considerations. The only thing we care about is saving this country and obtaining victory. We are bringing down lethal fire on Hamas. We've already killed off thousands of terrorists, and this is just the beginning, and we're also preparing for the ground offensive. I'm not going to give any specifics on when, how, and how much. I'm also not going to specify the various considerations we're taking into account. Many of these considerations are not known to the general population in Israel, and that's a good thing, because we want to protect our soldiers' lives. I would like to be clear. The timing of the IDF operation was determined unanimously by the cabinet in charge of this war. Together with the chief of general staff and together with the cabinet, we operate in order to guarantee the most optimal conditions for our troops for the upcoming activities. And when we get into Gaza and then later on, we're going to get those murderers who committed these horrendous, horrific events of Hamas, ISIS, to pay the full price. Once again, I call upon those who are uninvolved in Gaza. Leave and go to the south of the Gaza Strip. Leave your homes. Citizens of Israel, even amid wartime, we do not forget for one moment the terrible pain of the loss of over 1,400 of our brothers and sisters who were cold-bloodedly massacred and who were killed in heroic battles against these terrible monsters who wanted to kill us all. The loss of their lives are like arrows pointed at our heart. Our soul, the soul of this nation, is bleeding. We will determine national days of grieving for those who were killed. Elijah, one of the troops, was killed in the war, and his mother, Nava Lisha, grieved for him, eulogized when he was buried, and said, from the pains of this war, we will be reborn as a nation. And I think nobody could say it more aptly. I bow my head as I face all these families who are now facing such a terrible tragedy. I know that their lives will never be the same again. And I would like to send to them, to convey to them from the bottom of all Israelis, a big and loving embrace. The ministers of the government are doing everything they can in order to reach out and help those who need help. We have evacuated thousands of citizens who are in the confrontation lines to hotels and other arrangements, and that's fully funded by the state. And we are now formulating plans to provide additional assistance to all citizens of Israel, just as we did during COVID. We won't leave anyone behind, and the Minister of Finance will elaborate on that as soon as possible. We will rebuild and rehabilitate the kibbutzim and all the communities that have been so severely harmed. We've established 600 ready squads with new shipments of weapons coming from overseas, and we will add additional forces to this effort. We are encouraging citizens to start using weapons, but we're doing so in a controlled manner. We are rallying the support of world leaders to support our campaign, to continue with this campaign. Many of them understand today what we've been saying to them since 2014. Hamas is ISIS. And ISIS is Hamas. And I say to them that our war against Hamas is their war as well. Our war against Hamas is a test for all of humanity. It is a struggle between the axis of evil of Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and the axis of freedom and progress. We are the people of the light. They are the people of darkness. And light shall triumph over darkness. Citizens of Israel, October 7th was a very dark and black day in our history. We will fully investigate what had happened at our southern border, the border with Gaza. Everybody will have to provide answers, myself included, but all that will happen only after the war. As a prime minister, I'm responsible for guaranteeing the future of this country, and now my role is to lead all Israelis, the state of Israel and the people of Israel, to an overpowering victory. It is now a time to come together for one purpose, to storm ahead to achieve victory. In joint with joint forces and a profound belief in our justness, a profound belief in the eternity of the Jewish people, we shall realize the prophecy of Isaiah. There will no longer be stealing at your borders, and your gates will be of glory. Together we will fight. Together we will win.
Okay, folks, so that was, I apologize for that as well, the assault on the ears and on the spirit with that. But, again, folks, as I said earlier, we have to remember that in this language known as Jews speak, okay, just like when Netanyahu was holding up that picture of the bomb with the lit fuse at the UN, and he was associating that with Iran's nuclear program, what he was actually doing was threatening the entire world with incineration. And likewise with this speech that he gave, where he ends it with the prophecy of Isaiah. And again, folks, the Isaiah, part of the Old Testament, not part of the Torah, or I'm sorry, not part of the Talmud, principally deals with Israel's becoming the centerpiece of all, the headquarters of all human activity. Even Ben Gurion, who was an avowed atheist, okay, Israel's first prime minister, even he said, here, I want to make sure I've got the quote correctly, folks. Let's see here. Okay. Sorry, folks, I should have. Oh, gosh. Okay. Even Ben Gurion himself talked about the book of Isaiah and the prophecy of Isaiah, where Israel and specifically Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, would be the epicenter of not just of the world, but of the universe. And that all decisions, political decisions, religious decisions, cultural decisions, economic decisions for the entire universe would come out of Jerusalem. Now, in the previous soundbite where we heard all of this talk of Amalek and destroying Amalek, you have this one lisping Hebrew commentator who's talking about the book of Isaiah, the prophecy of Isaiah, and how, you know, the Messiah that the Jews are waiting for, that they've been waiting for thousands of years, that he will come out of Edom, this area that is considered Esau's kingdom, which is the West today, folks, that he will come out of Edom covered with the blood of all of his enemies, and that this will be the Messiah that the Jews are going to follow, okay, in establishing Israel as the headquarters of all activity on the planet. Now, Netanyahu references Isaiah, okay, where he talks about, you know, the prophecy of Isaiah is going to be realized, okay? Now, folks, what he's talking about there, again, just like him holding up that picture of the lit fuse on the bomb at the on the bomb at the UN, he's talking about what they're really planning to do, okay? It's not just Gaza. It's not just the Palestinians. It's the entire house of Esau. And in particular, you know, Netanyahu is very careful in what he talks about with regards to that prophecy in Isaiah, where he talks about it in a very innocuous and harmless way. But the specific section of Isaiah that he is quoting there, folks, it reads like this, okay? The Gentiles and their kings shall come to your light and to the brightness of your ascension. You shall drink their milk and draw milk from the breasts of their kings. Strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, and the sons of the foreigner shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. As you devour the riches of the Gentiles, they shall boast of your greatness and surrender unto you all of their gold and incense, while their children bow down to you and all those who rejected you fall prostrate at the soles of your feet. Their sons shall build up your walls and their kings shall minister to you as your gates remain open day and night so that their wealth may be placed at your feet and their kings led in humble procession before you. For the nation which will not bow down and serve you shall perish. It shall be utterly destroyed. That's the real prophecy that Netanyahu is referencing when he talks about that prophecy of Isaiah, and he specifically mentions the gates. Okay, he's mentioning that section where it says, your gates shall remain open day and night so that their wealth may be placed at your feet and their kings led in humble procession before you. Okay, that's what Netanyahu is really saying. That's what he was, the intention of this. And this is the conversation that they have when they're amongst each other. You know, anybody that's watched one of these gangster movies, they know that when the gangsters are communicating with each other, they have a language that's different than they use when they're, you know, talking amongst people who are not part of the club. Okay. I mean, like anybody who's, you know, watched Donnie Brasco, which was a real story. It really did happen, where this FBI agent named Joseph Pistone, he infiltrated the mafia in New York City, became one of them. And one of the things that they learned, one of the things that he learned, and which he conveyed in the book that he wrote called Donnie Brasco, very good book, folks. You should read it if you can get your hands on it, is that they have this language, this coded language that they use when they talk amongst each other, especially if they're in front of quote-unquote civilians, people who aren't part of the family, okay? Innocuous things that people wouldn't necessarily be able to put two and two together when they're listening to this type of talk. And it's this way with the followers of Judaism as well, folks. When they start citing prophecies, you know, and they make it sound very innocuous, like it's painting a picture of peace and all the rest of that stuff. That's not what they're really saying. What they're talking about is, you know, that the D-Day, Doomsday, is coming. All of our plans that we have put together for the last 3,000 years, just as Netanyahu said, all of the plans that we have put together for the last 3,000 years are about to be fulfilled. Now is the time for everybody to stay united and focused and not to get pulled off of their concentration with silly talks of peace or a ceasefire or anything like that. That's what this is all about, folks. And again, you know, and I have to stress this, those amongst us, you know, posing as the doctors and the thinkers who are not bringing these things out for us to hear and to understand, they're not doing us any services. It's a huge disservice, folks, because they are clouding our vision. They're taking the picture out of focus. And it's a picture, folks, that's actually very easy to understand. Like I said earlier, it's RFS, real freaking simple. Okay. These people are out to destroy us, and they have been on this mission to destroy us, not since 1948, but for thousands of years, literally thousands of years. Okay, folks, so I'm going to play one more soundbite here, one more soundbite, and it is the speech that Netanyahu gave at the UN General Assembly in September, just a few months ago, folks, just a few weeks before this all of this business, World War III and Armageddon, began, where he holds up this map. Okay, very similar to the visual aids that he used when he was holding up the bomb cartoon with the lit fuse, and he drew that red line across it, okay, red line with a red marker, and glared very menacingly to the people who were in attendance at that time. making his threats. Well, in this year's speech, Netanyahu held up another visual aid, only this time it was a map of the Middle East. And in the Middle East, there was no Palestine at all. And not only that, but he drew this red line, this very thick, conspicuous red line with his red marker. He said that it was a line that was going to be a line of prosperity between these Arab countries in the Gulf and Europe. But if you pay close attention, folks, to the way that that line is drawn, it looks very, very similar to what is the promised land described in the Old Testament, specifically the book of Genesis, going all the way to the Euphrates River. Okay. And again, folks, like I said, could I be reading more into this? Yes, I could be. Am I? I doubt it. Okay. Just like his bomb cartoon, I think was a threat to the world. I think that what he's doing here by holding up this map, he's talking about A, but what he really intends to get across is something entirely different. We're going to listen to this speech now.
A few years ago, I stood here with a red marker to show the curse, a great curse, the curse of a nuclear Iran. But today I bring this marker to show a great blessing, the blessing of a new Middle East between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and our other neighbors. We will not only bring down barriers between Israel and our neighbors, we'll build a new corridor of peace and prosperity that connects Asia through the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, to Europe. This is an extraordinary change, a monumental change, another pivot of history. But I also believe that we must not give the Palestinians a veto over new peace treaties with Arab states. Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
Okay, folks, that's it for the sound bites for today. Threat. But I'm going to use this speech he gave. And I apologize, folks, for the background music. I know it's kind of distracting, but these were the only things I could find on the web, on the internet. So he holds up this map. He draws this red line from southeast to northwest, and he's touting this as this corridor of peace and prosperity. That will result from Israel's peace agreements with the Arabs. But you have to remember something, folks. According to the Torah, according to the very same book that Netanyahu cited when he talked about wiping out Amalek, the Jews, the Israelites, the Hebrews, whatever you want to call them, they're not allowed to make any agreements, okay? The book of Deuteronomy states very specifically, folks, listen. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are to possess and drives out the many nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not save alive anything that breathes. Now, there's a lot more to it, folks, but that main thing there is make no treaties with them. Which means that all of these agreements, which Israel has been forced to make, beginning with President Carter's Camp David Accords, and then going forward to Bill Clinton's Oslo agreements and all of the rest of that stuff, including the peace agreements that Trump brokered with these Arab countries, Israel intends to break all of them. Okay. But you can't do it outwardly because to do that, and to speak plainly to the world, we're not interested in peace.
We are a warlike people. We live by the sword. And all of this land that I just drew this red marker here, you know, basically resembling the borders of biblical Israel, okay, the promised land, all of this, we intend to take it. It's ours. We're going to take it. We're just going to do this in a very clever way. We're going to start this war with Gaza. We're going to inflame the entire Islamic world, all 2 billion people. As a result of this, we will find ourselves at war with Egypt, and we will therefore break that peace treaty. We will find ourselves at war with Jordan, and we will break that peace treaty as well. We'll make it look like it's their fault that they started it, and the American people, especially the Christian evangelicals, they're going to buy every bit of it. They'll buy every bit of it. They're going to support us in this. And in the end, the intended end result of all of this is that America and the West is going to get embroiled in this as well, probably fighting Russia. We have to get the Russians out of Syria. We have to get them out of the Middle East. They're standing in the way of us attaining what it is that we were promised thousands of years ago. That's what this is all really about, folks. That's what it's really all about. And it's a lot closer than any of us would really like to imagine. Okay, I mean, things are moving along so quickly right now. And all that it's going to take, it's like, you know, embers, right? That they're just smoking. There's no flame. All that it takes is a little gust of wind, a little bit of oxygen. And then the whole thing just erupts into flames. And this is what these people have in store for us, folks. It's burning down and reducing to stubble the house of Esau. Now, is there any practical good that will come from this discussion, folks? Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, again, one of the things that we end the program saying every week is that we have to hope for and pray for a miracle. And I see that as, you know, this is our USS Liberty moment, folks, meaning that, you know, the USS Liberty had no chance. I mean, it was a done deal as soon as the Israelis initiated their attack. The USS Liberty stood no chance of surviving this thing. The Israelis knocked out their radio communications. They couldn't get a distress signal out. They had no way of defending themselves. It was just a signals intelligence gathering ship, so it's not like it had any kind of heavy weaponry. All that they could do was keep the ship afloat, keep it from sinking, and to pray for a miracle. And whatever prayers were said, folks, they were obviously answered that day, because if the ship had gone down, it would be a completely different world than what we are living in right now. That was the war that the Jews intended to get started in order to burn down the house of Esau. So I know this is kind of heavy stuff, folks. Well, no, it's not kind of heavy at all. It's real heavy. It's very distressing. And one of the most distressing things for me personally is that it's not being discussed in the manner that it should be. Instead, you have people, you know, in the same way that they laughed at Netanyahu when he made his speech at the UN. They called it the bomb cartoon. They said it was Looney Tunes. They didn't understand what he was really saying. And likewise, folks, with this latest thing that has happened and him reminding Israel, nuclear power that has smuggled nuclear weapons into every world capital, okay, and is using the threat of nuclear annihilation of these countries in order to blackmail these countries into giving Israel everything that she wants, the fact that nobody seems to put this very, very simple math together, this 2 + 2 = 4. It's very distressing, folks. But nevertheless, as we end every program, we're going to end it by saying, hope for and pray for that miracle, you know. If enough of us know the truth, and if enough of us are willing to speak the truth when all seems hopeless, maybe that's all that it takes to pull this thing over the finish line. Now, are we going to get through it Unscathed? No, folks. Just like the men on the USS Liberty. 34 men lost their lives. The rest of the men to this day are suffering the mental and the psychological and spiritual incapacitation and handicaps that they have from having gone through that horrific event. Okay. The blessings of which all of us have been enjoying for the last 55 years. So let's keep that in mind, folks, and let's push away, toss out, ignore, eliminate these people amongst us who have insinuated themselves into the discussions that are taking place these days, and who are saying that, you know, no, it's not this thing, it's this other thing over here. It simply isn't true, folks. It simply isn't true. You know, Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And as I was explaining in a conversation recently, you know, that verb, you will know, you will, okay, it has two meanings to it. You know, there is the future tense, such as, you know, you will be 20 years old this year on your birthday. Okay, so that's a statement about what's going to happen in the future. And then there is the commandment. There's the imperative by a commander who says to his soldiers, you will take that hill. You will storm that hill and you will take it. Okay. He's commanding them to do it. And when Jesus said to us, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free, he's saying you are obligated to find that truth, to pursue that truth. And everything that comes in your way that impedes you from finding that truth and setting yourself free, you are to view those things as tricks of the enemy. And it's like that with the world that we're living in today, folks. Our greatest enemy are these untruths that keep us from finding the truth, even when the truth is ugly, the ugliest that it can get. And in the process of keeping us from finding that truth, keeping us paralyzed in this state of permanent imprisonment. That's it for today, folks. I thank you for your time. I realize we jumped around a lot, may have been a little bit discombobulated. We do our best. We do our best. It's a very difficult thing to do when you're basically doing it alone, folks. You know, I don't think that I'm being arrogant in saying that you won't hear discussions like this in too many places. And unfortunately, you know, for all of us, but for me personally, I don't have the person that I had years ago that I would spend hours a day talking with, and we would toss ideas back and forth. And then, of course, I'm talking about my pipe. We don't have that person. I don't have that person. So I'm basically left to have these discussions in my mind by myself and with one other individual who does, you know, they do serve as a good replacement for Mike. But anyway, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your patience, your attention. That's it for today, folks. Let's all hope and pray for a miracle, because we need it.